Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining Getting the Most Out of Your Health Insurance conference call. Your host for today is Ms. Piper Reynolds. Ms. Reynolds, you may begin.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank everybody for joining our monthly teleconference this evening. It's really wonderful to have you all on the line with us. We are joined by three of the leading experts in the field of health insurance. Our featured guest speakers this evening include Liz Mercer, who is regional trainer, statewide health insurance benefits advisors helpline, and Washington State Office of the Insurance Commissioner, as well as Elizabeth Pelly, trustee and former insurance company executive, and John Wood, attorney and consumer advocate. Following this evening's teleconference, you will receive a program evaluation, which we urge you to complete, as your feedback and ideas will help us improve our programs to provide you with the most pertinent and helpful information and support. And finally, we encourage you to consider registering for future monthly teleconferences, which are always held on the first Thursday of every month from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, with alternating topics and speakers. Visit us online at msnorthwest.org or call 1-800-344-4867 to find out about our upcoming monthly teleconferences. And on a final note, during this presentation, we'll conduct several question and answer sessions. So if you'd like to ask a question, press the number 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to keep your questions general in nature and questions that might appeal to the larger group. And on that note, I will pass the floor off this evening, starting with John. Thank you.
Thank you, Piper, and hello, everyone. My name is, as Piper indicated, is John Wood. I'm a practicing lawyer here in Seattle, Washington, and I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight for our discussion about healthcare coverage. In the next hour, we're going to focus on some of the practical issues that people face when they're dealing with insurance companies and governmental health programs. We've kind of organized tonight's presentation into three segments. The first segment, which I'm going to address, discusses the most common type of healthcare coverage that's out there right now, and that is group health insurance that is sponsored by an employer. In other words, the type of insurance I'm going to talk about is provided through the workplace, and that's how most people in America get their healthcare insurance and healthcare coverage. As we're going to see, there are some special rules and procedures that apply to this type of group coverage. There is a special federal law that we're not going to get bogged down into in great detail, but I want you to be aware of it. It's called ERISA, and that's an acronym that stands for the Employer Retirement Income Security Act. If you got online on Google and just typed in ERISA, you would see many hundreds of pages about this federal law because it governs the health care that is obtained and other types of employee benefits that are obtained through work. So when you hear that term tonight from me and anybody else, ERISA, I'm talking about health insurance or health coverage that is obtained through employment, either by the worker, him or herself, and their beneficiaries, family members, and so forth. Our second segment is going to be addressed by our second speaker, Elizabeth Pelly, and she's going to talk about another form of private health insurance that is less common these days, and that is it's private health insurance that you might obtain from any of the big insurance companies or small insurance companies that handle healthcare, that are in the healthcare market, but that is not obtained through the employer. So you've got employer-based, and then Elizabeth is going to address the non-employer-based, and you often hear it referred to as non-ERISA health insurance. For example, to give you a sampling of that second type of insurance, a person may purchase health insurance and shop for it and go out and get health insurance on his or her own from a private insurance company. Elizabeth's going to talk about a few of the common issues that come up with that type of private health insurance. And then finally, our third segment speaker is Liz Mercer with the Office of the Insurance Commissioner in Washington State. And we're very fortunate to have Liz here tonight. She's got an extensive background in dealing with just about all forms of health care coverage and just about every issue that could come up revolving around that type of coverage. She's tonight, though, going to mainly focus on governmental health care coverage, such as questions that arise from Medicare and Medicaid. She's also going to talk a little bit about some of the features of the Federal Affordable Care Act that was signed into law last year that is going to drastically change some of the delivery of health care and health insurance coverage in the country. And she's also going to talk about some of the assistance that can be given with the state, the SHEBA program here in Washington State, and indicate that those types of programs are available in many other states as well. So our goal is to provide you with a good overview of the various healthcare options that are out there and some of the more common issues that, that flow from them. Much of what we are going to say is going to have some overlap to issues that are common throughout the country. For example, Medicare and Medicaid, a lot of those systems the Medicaid programs have a lot of the common features from state to state. However, at times, we might discuss issues that would be more pertinent to our member states here in the greater Northwest. As one example, as I mentioned earlier, Liz is going to talk a little bit about the statewide health insurance benefits advisors in Washington State, or the SHEBA program, but we'll indicate that other programs exist, similar programs in other states. After each of the three segments, we're going to have a short question and answer period. After I address employer-based coverage, for example, I will address any questions that you may have on that topic. We are going to try to, given our time limitations, address more general questions, but certainly I think any of the speakers will be available at a later time to address maybe more specific questions that you might have about your situation. So with that overview in mind, I'd like to start my segment about ERISA health coverage. And even though this area is very complex and can be highly legalistic, I'm going to try to my best not to sound like a lawyer when I discuss it. The most common form of health coverage in America is employer-sponsored coverage. This involves the employer either setting up and funding on its own a health care program or by an employer purchasing health insurance for its employees. Sometimes there's even a combination of that self-funding up to a certain point and insurance that may kick in above a certain dollar level, and they're all different types of variations of that. The employer-based coverage is in contrast to the second segment, as I already indicated, where a person obtains a health insurance outside of the workplace setting. That federal law called ERISA applies to employer-provided health insurance. There are a few notable times when, even though you get your insurance through work, that this federal ERISA law does not apply. It does not apply even though you get your insurance through the workplace if you work for a governmental entity or you work for a religious organization. Those are the two biggest exceptions. So you may have the exact same private health insurance policy as your neighbor, and you work for a government, a local government, and your neighbor works for a private company, and you would have two different laws that apply to your two different or the same exact insurance policy. So let's discuss what ERISA really in a practical way means, because we know it's a law that is there. It does not in any way really dictate what type of health coverage must be provided by an employer. This may change over the next few years as the federal law goes into effect, but historically and as of right now, it's just like anything else. Some health insurance provided is better than other health insurance. So there is not a federal mandate of that this so-and-so procedure has to be covered in all policies. The ERISA law is really more about a procedural, the safeguards that are put into place to make sure that the employees and their beneficiaries have a fair shot at getting the coverage that is provided under the terms of the plan. So it's more about enforcing your rights to the coverage that you have rather than dictating what specific coverage you are provided. When you have health insurance through that group plan, the single most important document is called, wouldn't you know it, the plan. The plan can either be a document written by the employer or the insurance policy issued by the insurance company. So if you remember one thing from ERISA-based insurance, is if you ever have a question about what benefits are provided, you need to obtain a copy of the plan. Sometimes the employers will publish these glossy brochures that are called summary plan descriptions, and as that name indicates, because it's a summary, it may not address every single issue that may come up, but provides the overall thrust of the coverage. And sometimes there's a more detailed document called the plan itself, and you would need to ask your human resources office for a copy of any plan documents that exist. And I would ask for both the summary plan and the actual full plan. And sometimes there can even be inconsistencies between the two, such that if there's any ambiguity, a lot of courts will construe it in favor of the employee and the beneficiary. So when you want to know what you are entitled to, even though they're not always very readable, it's very important to get a copy of the actual plan. And like I said, it can be either an insurance policy or a document that is written for employees by the employer. The plan, as I indicated, addresses the specifics regarding your coverage. It might talk about which doctors in a network you can see. It might address the types of coverages that are available to you. Some plans put limits and restrictions on certain health conditions. There are often clauses that ban pre-existing conditions, and you have to read carefully. For example, some might say after you've worked for the company for 6 months, it doesn't matter whether you have had a pre-existing condition in the past, but then others may be more restrictive. So when you're planning your health care, no one wants to wait to get care for their condition. But in terms of coverage, you do need to read the specifics to see whether the coverage is allowed or not. The plan will also likely address your responsibility and obligations. There are many, many complexities of ERISA, and a lot of those turn on time limits. There are certain time limits, and these can vary from plan to plan to plan, for filing a claim for insurance, a deadline for appealing any denial if you've been denied by your health insurance company, and a deadline, if it ever comes to it, for filing a lawsuit. Under that ERISA law, missing a deadline can be fatal by itself to a claim for health coverage. Sometimes even it goes so far as that a plan will include a deadline for filing a case in court that is actually shorter than the legal statute of limitations, and those types of shortened deadlines have even been upheld by most of the courts, as long as there is some reasonable time for pursuing your rights. So it may look dry and boring to look at, but you, and if you need to have somebody help you read through it that has some legal experience, it's always the starting point is to try to figure out what the obligations and rights of both yourself and the employer or insurance company are. So with that in mind, the plan is what you can hold up and hold the employer and the insurance company accountable for. They have to live up to those obligations. The vast majority of healthcare expenses are paid without a dispute. As a lawyer, I end up seeing a lot of these once there is a dispute in play, but overwhelmingly health expenses are paid routinely. The employee simply presents his or her health insurance card to the provider, and the provider processes the paperwork with the insurance carrier and receives payment. And so we don't need to spend a lot of time discussing the routine transactions. The ones that are more troublesome seem to have come as the cost of health care have exploded over the last years. And as a result of that, there seem to be many more disputes, especially when there's expensive treatment in consideration, and there may be a dispute about whether it's even reasonable or necessary. As an example, I can think of a time where a brain surgeon wanted to implant a stimulator within a patient's brain to try to reduce this chronic excruciating headache pain, and the procedure was going to cost over $100,000, but so many other avenues had been pursued without success. So there was a dispute between the patient and the doctor on the one hand, and they were disputing the insurance company's determination that it was an experimental procedure. So that is more and more these days how there comes to be a problem with obtaining health insurance is it's very expensive, and there's enough latitude that a health plan or insurance company can argue that it's really experimental and not reasonable and necessary. And reasonableness and necessity are kind of the linchpins of health insurance about whether a treatment is going to be provided for the most part. So again, when there is a dispute such as that, it is important to go back to the plan. If the plan promises to pay for reasonable and necessary medical care, then it's vitally important to establish that the requested procedure is reasonable and necessary. And this, again, because I mentioned ERISA is not about telling them what they have to cover, but giving you a framework to pursue your claim, this is why ERISA becomes very important again. ERISA requires that health plan provide to the employees what is known as a, quote, full and fair review of claims. It involves deadlines for the plan or its insurer to make a decision on the claim and a requirement that the plan notify the beneficiary or participant about the claim decision. And then the third part, a reasonable period of time for the employee to appeal the denial. So you've got the initial claim, a deadline, and it's usually in the plan, and then a time that the carrier gets to make a decision, and then if it's a denial, a certain length of time that the carrier has to process and make a decision on the appeal. And when I say appeal, I mean internal appeal. This is everything I'm talking about is before you would have to go to court. You go through this administrative process, including that internal appeal, to try to resolve it without the need to go to court. So that process is commonly known in legal circles as exhausting your administrative remedies. You have to really look at that plan language, which is supposed to be in accordance with these ERISA regulations, to look at the actual days that you have and the days that they have to make their decisions. And then finally, if all avenues are exhausted, the law allows a beneficiary the right to file a lawsuit over the denied coverage. So what does that mean on a practical level? If a health expense claim is denied, the ball kind of goes back into the patient's court. The patient needs to act to protect his or her rights, and that first step, as I mentioned, is to get the documents for the plan or the policy. But after there is a denial, you have a right under law to get a copy of not only the policy or the plan documents, but all the documents that were in the claims file of the insurance carrier. And they have up to 30 days to provide that full claims file to you, or else there can be a penalty of $110 a day. So they're required to show you exactly what they looked at and who they consulted and what outside or inside opinions they got to justify their decision, so that you can then craft your appeal knowing exactly what happens to that point. The denial that they make is supposed to set forth their specific reasons and rationale. So, you know, along with getting the claims file, they should provide you under the regulations with the reasoning for why they denied the case or denied the claim. Most physicians then, now that it's back in your court, you're looking at how do I appeal this decision? I really have to have this health care. And the physicians are usually your best friend in this process because they're usually willing to help show that the needed procedure is justified and reasonable and necessary. And that can involve the physician writing a detailed letter explaining why a procedure is reasonable and necessary or addressing some of the specific concerns of the insurance company. It can also involve the physician speaking with the in-house medical department of the insurance company. When the patient submits the appeal, it might also include other things other than the doctor's statements. It can include statements from other physicians or medical researchers discussing the reasonableness of the procedure. And in this appeal,
you really want to be as creative as you can. So if you know that your treating doctor is advocating for it, but there is also a leading researcher at the, you know, your university medical center who maybe has written articles, you can even contact them and say, could you help provide literature for me, or could you write a short statement for me indicating the state of the art of this procedure that's in question. It can also include non-medical things, just personal statements of both you as the patient, the family members, friends, coworkers, talking about the condition, that how this is affecting your life, and how you've tried and struggled through other forms of medical care, and this is the one thing that you have looked for to try to help, and how, you know, maybe you can find other patients who have gone through this same procedure that can say how much it helped them. So they're really, these appeals sometimes can be hundreds of pages, because you really want to throw everything at the plan to show them that you deserve to have that coverage, and that the procedure in question is reasonable and necessary. The appeal might also include your own medical research that you can do. There are so many good websites now online that talk about conditions and the most current types of treatment that are available. And really, it's used to try to educate the insurance carrier. And they're not always doing this just in bad faith. There may just be a lack of communication and education that can help turn the corner, especially if your doctor's involved. And the other argument is that early treatment, even if it might be expensive, can often lower the overall medical expenses down the road, and that can be another issue that the doctor can address. And the National MS Society has some sample very, very good and impressive letters that are kind of templates for your doctor to look at and modify as necessary, but for specific drugs, for specific treatments, that are, when I looked through the book, I was just amazed at the amount of work that had gone into that, that can be good sample letters for the doctor to use as a starting point. If the claim is denied, and we're talking about this appeal, and the appeal, after you've gone through that process, is also denied, there are sometimes situations where patients really have no choice but to go to court. And, you know, these are the kind of cases you see on the headlines, and they're particularly true when a procedure, you know, can be a life or death type situation without the medical care. And as I said, those are the cases that make the headlines, but the vast, vast majority of healthcare issues are resolved without having to go to court. But you need to know that option is there, just in case there's something absolutely critical about obtaining it. This is, of course, once you're into the court system, another time where the ERISA law and its case law that supports it is very important. The ERISA law requires that a patient fully complete the appeals process as specified in the plan before he or she can even go to court. Now, when you're thinking about healthcare, it's often urgent that a healthcare procedure be performed, and unlike other forms of employee benefits like disability coverage or life insurance coverage, the ERISA law mandates that urgent care requests must be resolved on a much, much quicker basis by the insurance company. If somebody needs a transplant, or not even something that critical, but an urgent care situation that the doctor can vouch for, those types of claims have to be decided generally within 72 hours. And then even on the appeal, that has to be decided within 72 hours. And one criticism that you hear of the ERISA law is that there is no traditional trial allowed. In the normal case that you have out there, say a car wreck, if the plaintiff is constitutionally allowed a jury trial, as are almost all types of cases in our nation, where you can present new witnesses and evidence to the jury, and the jury makes the decision. In an ERISA benefits case, the judge makes the decision without, generally speaking, hearing any new witnesses or evidence. The judge's decision is usually limited, for the most part, to evidence that is already put into the claims file during the underlying claims and appeal. So not only are you doing this claim and appeal to try to not have to go to court, you know, in other words, you want to convince the health plan to pay for the coverage without having to go to court, but if you have to go to court, generally speaking, the only thing the judge will be able to look at is what's already in the claims file. So remember that as you're trying to build your record with doctor's statements and so forth, that it could be something that the judge ends up making his or her decision on. So the other criticism that you hear is that ERISA, unlike state law, which is the second type of coverage that Elizabeth is going to cover, in ERISA, if you win in court, you're generally speaking only entitled to the denied benefit. In other words, the cost of the care. There is a chance of getting attorney's fees, but by and large, you're fighting over the denied benefit. When you're not dealing with ERISA and you've just gotten your health insurance from the private market on your own, you kind of have a bigger piece of leverage, because if they deny you in what's called bad faith without any reasonable justification, they can be held liable for not only the denied benefit, but in some cases more of a punitive type damage as well. So ERISA has that additional limitation that it protects the employers to usually only have to pay the amount of the benefit that was denied, and then the possibility of some attorney's fees and interest. Another limitation of the ERISA law is that if the legal standard that the court will apply is generally gives deference to the decision of the health plan. It doesn't mean it's impossible to overturn it, but you, in most cases, don't go into court with an even 50-50 type of situation. The law in ERISA essentially, and this is oversimplistic, but it basically says that the health plan's decision will be afforded discretion to some degree and will not be overturned if they had some reasonable basis to overturn it. And again, that's why it's so important to really document the claims file and appeal in case there's ever a question of whether they had any reasonable basis for denying it. And let's see, getting ready to end, so if you have any questions in the back of your mind, if you can put them together, because I think we'll be done in a minute here. If you have an experienced and proactive human resources department, for example, it can be helpful to get them and keep them involved in this health insurance process. They're usually good, and they understand how this works, and they want to help the employees. That's generally why they're there. And in my experience, insurance carriers sometimes feel more compelled to provide a particular health benefit if the employer that pays for that insurance is involved in the process of advocating for it. And don't forget that there are other kinds of employee benefits that sometimes go in tandem with health insurance that is provided through work. Some employers provide, for example, short-term disability and long-term disability and pensions that may kick in based upon a health condition and the inability to work, and other things like rehabilitation or vocational benefits. So I often talk to people who weren't aware that there are other options out there than something that there also have to be plans put in place by the employers to provide. They don't have to provide any of those other coverages, but if they're there, it's good to check to see if they apply to you. And so I guess now I'd like to see if anyone has any general questions about this ERISA, this employer-based health coverage, and be happy to address anything that comes to mind.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Again, if there's any questions you have, please press the number 1 key on your phone. We have one question in queue. Our first question comes from Lori. Go ahead, Lori.
Actually, my question was just about insurance in general and Medicare, and so it doesn't sound like we're talking about that, so I don't know whether this can be addressed or not.
That one's probably best if we address that. I'm sure it's going to be pertinent to what we're talking about, but it might be better to raise that when Liz is speaking, because she's going to talk about Medicare. And then if there are other issues that go along with that, we'll all be happy to jump in.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there's any questions you have, please press the number 1 key on your phone now. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, then let's move to our second speaker, who is, again, Elizabeth Pelley. And Elizabeth is going to talk about this other type of private health insurance that people obtain on their own or as a result, as I said, through employment with a governmental entity or a religious organization. So, Elizabeth, it's all yours.
Thank you, John, and good evening, everyone. Again, I'm going to talk a little bit about insurance plans where if you couldn't get coverage through an association or a public plan and your employer doesn't provide health insurance, you bought coverage directly from an insurance company. So many of the topics covered in John's presentation for employer-purchased health care plans are similar to these health plans. And once again, these are plans that are purchased directly through an insurance company. So you're going to hear some common themes about claim denials and appeals, and this discussion will sound a little repetitive. But we felt it was important to break this out because you, in purchasing from a private carrier, you don't have a corporate human resources department or federal law acting as your advocate. So what I'm going to do is try to focus your attention on some common sense guidelines about the common issues that MS patients are dealing with in this market. Specifically, I'm going to talk about some of the confusion about pre-existing conditions, what to do when your insurer denies your doctor's pre-authorization for services, and finally, the denial of claims for treatment. So just to begin for background, I've worked in the healthcare industry for 25 years on both the provider and the insurer side. So most recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, I have been working closely with the Greater Northwest Chapter for patient advocacy. And through all of the questions and complaints that come to the chapter, one of the things that I find that I really want to emphasize is that you, the patient, are your most important advocate as a member of your health plan. And again, because you don't work for a big corporation and you don't have those human resources departments, it is you that is the most important advocate. So we recognize that MS is a complex disease and that MS treatments are really unique to the patient. So like John, one of the things I'm going to emphasize is you really need to understand your plan and what your policy covers. That knowledge is power. So you should carefully review your health benefits information on an ongoing basis to ensure that you understand your medical coverage and your out-of-pocket expenses and your member rights. It's important to know what treatment is covered and to know what treatments require prior approval. I'm going to continue with a few statements about pre-existing conditions as a part of your policy. In purchasing your policy, you should always check to see how your policy defines pre-existing conditions. Now, these are medical conditions that were present before you enrolled in a coverage plan. And insurance companies will differ on what constitutes a pre-existing condition. So this is the key to understanding how your treatment will be covered initially with your insurer. If you have MS, your policy may or may not cover treatment of conditions that existed before your enrollment, and some companies will cover it with waiting periods for as long as 9 months. So your policy outlines the definition of pre-existing conditions, and knowing this will avoid a dispute. And like John says, these disputes are something that I'm going to talk a little bit more about also, that there's two areas of discussion, the denial of the pre-authorization for services and the denial of claims. So how do you handle a denial of a pre-authorization of service? So some insurance companies require a pre-authorization for services or equipment or the filling of a prescription. So, yes, no surprise, it's possible that your insurance company may not authorize the recommendations made by your physician. You should receive or ask for a written explanation as to why the treatment or prescription or equipment was not approved. Take the time to review the denial explanation or contact your insurer's member services for assistance in the explanation. Next, talk to your physician. Together, you should consider sending the additional documentation showing why that prescribed treatment or drug or equipment is medically necessary. And as John spoke before, you can contact the MS chapter, which has access to all the letter templates for appeals. They have access to expert opinion papers and other reports which describe the need for and the benefits of all of these certain therapies in your treatment of MS. This appeals process is very effective because insurance companies will consent because of the additional information provided during the appeals process. And you'll find that the material there is from national experts that will assist your own insurance company with understanding what the treatments are for. So let me pause. I've talked a little bit fast, and I've talked briefly about pre-existing conditions and the denial of pre-authorizations of treatments. So before I move on to my next topic on claim denials, this is just a reminder that I will take questions at the end of this session. So if you have questions that you want to prepare about those topics, you can go ahead and think about those. So I'm on to my third topic, which is the dreaded how do you handle a claim denial. So what is your recourse if your insurance company is refusing to pay for medical treatment or a prescription? And that, of course, is the appeals process. John also spoke about this, and the themes are really, really similar. So let me make some brief comments on two areas. We're talking about the internal appeal, where you're appealing directly to your insurer, and the possibility of an external appeal when you are appealing to an outside board. So let me talk a little bit about the internal appeals process because it is your first step. You probably will not have access to any external process until you've completed your insurer's internal appeals. So again, let me emphasize, be prepared with knowledge to know how many days you have to challenge a denial for services. Carefully review the denial, which should be documented in an explanation of benefits, explaining why the procedure or prescription was denied. Again, it's very important to take action immediately and to understand your policy as to what is covered. Call the insurance company directly and speak to a member services representative. Explain why you think you should be covered, referring to specific provisions of the plan if possible. If this route isn't successful, ask to speak to a supervisor, and do not hesitate to work through the chain of supervisors. Take notes, and you can't take enough notes so that you can refer back to specific individuals or comments that were made in those discussions. So if phone calls don't work, file a written appeal, which may be your insurance company's preferred method of disputes. So each insurance company has its own requirements for what should be included, but be sure to include your name and address, your physician's name and address, and a detailed explanation of what was denied and why you believe that denial was wrongful. You may also contact the MS chapter. Just as for pre-authorizations, they have access to letter templates, expert opinion papers, and other reports describing the need and the benefits of those therapies in your treatment of MS. It's just like John said, an appeal can be hundreds of pages, but consider sending these resources with your appeal along with letters of support. And I also want to emphasize engaging your doctor in the appeals process. Always engage your doctor in the appeals process. Save copies of your communication and call to follow up if you do not receive a response within a reasonable time. Now, your insurance company may have other internal appeals options. You need to check your policy. So what is an external appeal? If the internal appeals process isn't working and the insurance company still refuses coverage, you can begin an external appeals process if your policy allows. I want to say that to date, I've not seen any complaints that were not resolved within the internal appeals process. However, most states allow for these appeals to an independent board to review the denials, but the process will be different in each state. So again, I have just some things that I'd like to leave you with to remember. The topics that I discussed are common sense and generalized approaches, and they're not groundbreaking news, but I see evidence that these suggestions are very effective in disputes with many of the carriers. So again, the key to having your insurer respect your rights and responsibilities is being knowledgeable about your health plan coverage, and most of all, actively advocating your position. Secondly, consulting with your physician. We're very fortunate in the state of Washington that the MS specialists are so knowledgeable about the insurers and how to navigate the appeals process. They're probably your most powerful advocates. And thirdly, use the chapter as a resource. As John spoke, we have tons of documentation that are at your fingertips to assist in your appeals, because these are trying times and you're getting your appeals through will be absolutely essential, and these are ready-made for you to go. So that concludes my presentation, and I hope that some of these guidelines are helpful to you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if there's any questions you have, please press the number one key on your phone now. Again, if you have a question, please press the number one key on your phone now. There are no questions at this time.
Thank you.
Okay. And before we go to our third speaker, I did want to say that I couldn't agree more with Elizabeth in terms of not only working with your doctor, but whether it's through work or just whether your insurance company has been obtained through the workplace or you got it on your own, reaching out to the insurance company or the health plan is, there's nothing to be hesitant there. They are there to try to assist you, and in fact, they have a fiduciary legal responsibility to assist you through, for example, the appeals process. If you call or write and say, I want an explanation why this was denied, they have an obligation to tell you. And the same goes for, what are my deadlines? I know I've read in my policy that it appears I have this much time. Can you confirm that to me? That is why they're there, and they're supposed to provide accurate information that they deal with day to day. So it's on all fronts, I agree with Elizabeth, using as resources your medical team and friends and family and your own resources and researching the issues, but then also using the information that should be provided from either your employer or the member services line. So with that, I do want to leave us with our third and final speaker, who is Liz Mercer. And Liz is going to talk, as I mentioned before, about governmental health programs and a little bit about the state of Washington's SHEBA program. So Liz, the floor is yours.
Thank you, John. And thank you, Elizabeth. I also welcome everybody. Thank you for having me. I wanted to also reiterate that the information that John and Elizabeth gave is very pertinent to coverage through either Medicaid or Medicare. Both programs have appeal processes that are set out with timelines and all that kind of thing. And so I'm not going to talk so much about that, but I want you to remember that those programs, if you are taking advantage of them, are very similar in terms of appeals for denial of care. So I'm going to sort of change gears a little bit because my point of view is slightly different. I'm not a real expert on MS, but what I can tell you about is kind of a little bit of help about understanding and navigating. So first of all, SHEBA, which stands for Statewide Health Insurance Benefits Advisors, is a program in the state of Washington. It's a program of the Washington State Insurance Commissioner, where we have trained volunteers around the state who assist people to understand and navigate their health insurance options, including individual insurance, employer insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, and other ways to help pay for health care coverage. There are programs all over the U.S. that are similar to SHEBA in the fact that they help people in the Medicare arena. They're called SHIP, State Health Insurance Assistance Programs. And I'm assuming, I don't know for sure, that I sent some links to Piper to have them sent out to the group that are participating, and I'm hoping there are some links that are going to be available to you guys to get more information about, first of all, SHEBA, if you're in Washington State, but I understand callers are calling from other states as well. So there is a link on how to find a program like SHEBA in other states. So having said that, people in Washington State who call our toll-free line are connected with a volunteer who can discuss with them their individual circumstances and try to help them navigate. So I've been asked to talk really about three things, and I'm going to be pretty quick because we're going to run out of time. But first of all, just about Medicaid. Many people who are not able to access employer or able to afford an individual health care policy may participate in a Medicaid program. Medicaid is a state-run program, a combination of federal and state dollars, generally programs for low income, people with limited income. Every state has slightly different eligibility rules and that kind of stuff, but in general, people who get on a Medicaid program have limited income and assets and probably have to fit into a category such as being a child, being pregnant, being a senior over 65, or being disabled. So I did send out a link about what Medicaid looks like in different states. But again, people who are eligible for a Medicaid program have, again, it's not exactly a benefits book, but Medicaid is going to cover things that are considered to be medically necessary. I think John used slightly different terms, but a lot of what is covered under these programs has to be defined as medically necessary. So there are, within the program themselves, there are rules about if something is denied or not covered, timelines for appealing those decisions, and actually a method for escalating those appeals if it's denied at the first level, where you can take it to the second and level and so on. Okay. Regarding Medicare, Medicare is federal health insurance program, generally is the one that covers people over 65, but also covers some people with disabilities. Usually those are people who have been collecting Social Security disability benefits for 2 years. Okay. When we talk to people about Medicare coverage, which SHEBA and the SHIPs that are around the country do a lot of, we spend a lot of time talking to people about the fact that Medicare doesn't cover everything. It covers some medically necessary care, doctor and hospital care. You would have to buy a supplement for prescription drug coverage. That's what we call Part D. And there are copays and deductibles. So Medicare, we frequently talk to people about how they're going to pay for the parts of Medicare that aren't covered. And also, again, with Medicare, just like with Medicaid and individual and employer coverage, there are procedures for appealing denials of coverage for benefits that people are trying to get from that program. Again, I just want to mention again that Medicare in particular, there is, I know there is a national program called SHIP, State Health Insurance Assistance Partnership Program, excuse me, that you can access a person in any state to help with navigating Medicare. I want to give you guys a couple of minutes for questions. I was also asked to talk about the Affordable Care Act, how we can throw all this into the last few minutes. Affordable Care Act, or health care reform as some people know it, just want to briefly touch on it. People have been hearing a lot about it. There's a lot of news coverage. The important thing to know is that most changes in the Affordable Care Act don't go into effect until the year 2014, assuming that it goes forward and is not taken apart by Congress. But if and when it's fully implemented, people will be able to buy insurance if they don't have it through an employer without any pre-existing condition inclusion, no annual limits on coverage, those kind of things. Also, there will be assistance for people with limited income to purchase or to get on a Medicaid program, regardless of whether or not they meet all the other issues around being disabled and so on and so forth. So the biggest one for that is people whose income is under 133% of the federal poverty guidelines would be eligible to enroll in Medicaid regardless of whether they have children or are deemed disabled and that sort of thing. And just for basis of comparison, 133% of the federal poverty guidelines for an individual right now is an annual income of somewhere around $14,500 a year. That changes a little bit each year. Again, with the Affordable Care Act, some changes have already taken place, notably for people with MS might be the pre-existing condition insurance plans that most states have now up and running, where a person who has not been able to purchase insurance or get employer insurance because of their condition could buy into an insurance plan if they have been uninsured for 6 months or longer. Also, for people who are already on Medicare, some of the Affordable Care Act changes have included people who hit the donut hole in Medicare get discounts on their prescriptions of 50% for brand names. And then finally, preventive care for people on Medicare for starting this year with no cost sharing. And I'm rushing through this because I want to give you a couple minutes to ask questions. And so I think what I will do at this point is open it up if anybody has questions. Is our operator there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if there's any questions that you have, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if there's a question that you have, please press the number one key on your phone now. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press 1.
We all fell asleep.
There are no questions in queue at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, do you want to finish anything up, John?
It looks like we're pretty close to the end point anyway. You mentioned that most of these changes take effect in the year 2014. Are there any changes? We've heard about the children being on the parents' policy until age 26.
Oh,
we've
yes.
Heard about, are there any things that are going to be happening before 2014?
Well, there is. I sent out a link to a timeline. The Kaiser Family Foundation has a great timeline link on what's happening. So some things are being phased in the next, couple of years. Nothing jumps out at me right at the moment.
But the things like the major things like pre-existing conditions and the exchanges and so forth are a few years away.
We still have to somehow muddle through the next 3 years before that happens. So
I guess since we have a minute or two, I kind of, if you wouldn't mind giving a flavor of what the SHIBA advisors, the types of calls that they would handle and what type of advice or assistance they provide on a practical level.
Okay. Well, people call for all kinds of reasons, but particularly we do get a lot of calls from people who have MS. Generally, the questions that they are asking us have to do with Medicare or going on to Medicare, moving from maybe being on SSDI and not being on Medicare to meeting their 2 years, going on to Medicare, how to choose a drug plan that's going to meet their needs, a prescription drug plan, how to figure out how to supplement Medicare when they have, many of these people are not yet 65, and so they have different options for supplementing Medicare than people who are 65 and over and on Medicare have. Those are probably the big things that are coming up, how to pay those for the large drug costs that they end up having, and whether there's any other assistance out there, which probably the MS Society has some more help with than we do, but we do direct people to, you know, patient assistance programs to help pay for prescriptions and those kind of things.
Do you field questions about private insurance, whether it be individual or group?
Yes, we do, and we do try to educate people particularly about how to move from one kind of insurance to another without health screenings, because at least in the state of Washington, there's a fairly complicated rules and laws about when you do and don't have to be screened when you're purchasing like an individual plan, so how to do that for most people, how to help them avoid that and plan for the next move in their insurance lifetime, so to speak.
Right. Well, great. That's a wonderful summary, and I think we're at our one-hour mark, so unless anybody has any questions, I think we're ready to wrap up. And so, operator, can you wrap us up?
Yes. Would you like them to ask more questions, sir?
Well, I guess you've already asked. I guess we could, since we have a minute, just to see if there are any questions before we close this out.
Okay. We have one question. Kathleen Mitchell. Go ahead, Kathleen.
I wanted to find out, you had said something back on, this is for Mr. Wood, and I'm sorry,
yes.
Back with the health care, that the employer, all of those policies and the questions that you had covered had not to do with private or employer-based health insurance that came from a government sector or through, there was one other restriction.
A church organization?
Right, and what exactly was the limitation on those? Is that because the government or the religious organization sets up their own policies, and so the requirements and the specific appeal rights are different?
They are totally different, and it's just by the way the statute was drafted. It doesn't necessarily have any logical reason other than that's just the way that the law was churned out. And it has its main effect that we went through the types of protections and safeguards that ERISA affords, the full and fair review process and the appeal that has to take place and the time limits and so forth. And that does apply to employer-based coverage, except for people that may even have the identical private insurance policy, except they got theirs through let's say they work for the city of Spokane. They could have the same exact insurance policy issued by a private insurer and have their coverage be decided and administered under the type of scheme that Elizabeth was describing, where you go through their appeal process, but then if you have to go to court, you have a different, you have state law that would apply rather than the federal protections. And as I indicated, most people would say that state law would provide in some respects, a greater leverage for the patient or the beneficiary or plan participant when they are not covered by ERISA than they would if they were covered by ERISA. So it is kind of a bright line. There is often litigation about whether, let's say, a religiously affiliated hospital is a church organization, and there's some gray area, and it's a complicated administrative process to declare yourself a religious organization, and in some instances you can opt in to ERISA protections and have ERISA apply. So it can seem to be arbitrary, because it is, but it's as simple as that. Identical health policy or plan, one obtained through a government employer or a religious affiliated employer, and one through a private, a Motorola or Adobe or a big private employer, can have two different legal schemes that would relate to it.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I really want to thank all three of you for participating and providing all this information. It sounds like we just really need to be proactive and know what our policy reads and
yes.
be ahead of the game and be ready to take all the necessary actions to appeal any decision that we think hinders us from getting the health care that we need.
Yes. Thank you for being here tonight. Good question.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that concludes our program. We appreciate everyone attending, and feel free to follow up with any of us or with the Greater Northwest Chapter of the National MS Society with any follow-up questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.